It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
Your behavior just hasn't been very oozy.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me!
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it. It was a late night last night. Still had over 1,500 people left hanging with me live at 2:30 in the morning for the AEW Full Gear review. 4 hours of sleep later, I see that we had even more news overnight, with a major challenge issued for Wrestle Kingdom at the Tokyo Dome, and a first-time-ever IWGP Women's Champion crowned. I'm going to be talking about that. I'm going to be talking about the new AEW World Heavyweight Champion, the 26-year-old prodigy himself, MJF, after an excellent show last night in Newark, one of their best all year, and the media scrum that came after the show. No muffins this time. I know Mindy will be very disappointed. Maybe she should set up shop in Newark if she wants to expand her business. But there is smoke to the fire when it comes to Stone Cold Steve Austin coming back for another match, but against who? The field for War Games has been set, which is good because Survivor Series is less than a week away, so they kind of had to. Chris Jericho wants pro wrestling to be an Olympic sport. Scotty Too Hotty tweets something that in 2022 apparently qualifies for controversial, which tells me that people have too much free time on their hands. NXT has found its replacement for War Games. Tales from the Territories takes us to Portland this week. We got a lot to cover. This is episode 783 of the Sleepy Solo Monster sounding off for Sunday, November 20th, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. We are in the middle of a Black Friday sale on ProWrestlingTees.com, so if you would like to get 20% off any shirt in our store, including the new 15-year anniversary logo shirt, go to ProWrestlingTees.com/SoloMonsterSoundsOff. The Black Friday sale runs all the way through next Monday. And you don't have to apply a coupon code or anything. It's automatically applied. So, as Kevin Nash once said on WCW television, buy the shirt! If you would like to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolemonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on the show. These are our PayPal producers for this week. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, delivering as always. More than the mailman. Paul, you are awesome. Big B, Bryant Becerra, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Killshot, Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Billy Hardcore Habibi, Shin Superkick Akuma, The Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lampier, Fired Up, Alyssa Figueroa. And I also want to give a shout-out to the Lightning Link Lounge. If you like playing games online, whether it's on your PC or your tablet or your phone, and you want to try to win some money, check out the Lightning Link Lounge. You can play slots like Lightning Link, Dragon Link, Buffalo. You can play Keno, shooting games, poker games like Texas Hold'em, Blackjack, and Roulette. Thousands of games to choose from, and they pay winners every single day. In fact, their record win so far is 30 grand. Now, I haven't won 30 grand, but I've tried it and I had fun playing Dragon Coin and Candy Heroes. For more information, search for Lightning Link Lounge on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok. You must be 18 years or older to play. Ages may vary outside the U.S. ID is required. Text 727-910-8809 to get started. On Thursday night, we did a watch-along for the Elimination Chamber match, the very first one from Survivor Series 2002, given that it was the 20-year anniversary. I pushed the audio out for that one as well, since we were also celebrating 15 years of the Sound Off that night. I was answering a whole bunch of questions. Typically, the watch-alongs do not get pushed out to the feed. They are reserved for YouTube, but again, this was a special occasion, so if you missed it, go check that out. And one other thing I wanted to mention here before I get into all the Full Gear stuff. An anniversary from this week. It was 10 years ago this past Friday that The Shield made their debut at the Survivor Series. Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and Roman Reigns arrived on the scene. They were main eventers in WWE from day one. They interfered. They helped CM Punk retain the WWE Championship. These guys were in the top mix from the very first appearance they made on television. And now, all these years later, now, a decade later, Moxley obviously is out of the company. He just lost his championship last night. He's doing big things in AEW, and he's doing whatever he wants, basically. He's working GCW, he's working different indies, New Japan. He's living life the way that he wants to live it. Nobody can deny the fact that he has had a lot of success since leaving WWE. He's parlayed that into a nice run for himself. Even in WWE, he was a WWE champion, Intercontinental champion, Tag Team champion. He did well for himself. Seth Rollins, also, still all these years later, a headliner, doing big things in the company. He's worked with all the big names, whether it's Triple H or Brock Lesnar, John Cena, you know, whoever it may be. And then there's Roman Reigns, who is in the midst of the strongest championship run in this company since the days of Hulk Hogan. He has been the champion now for over 2 years. He is completely dominant. The Bloodline is the top faction in the company. So I think it's safe to say that Roman Reigns went on to achieve all the things that Vince McMahon had hoped he would be. But really, he took off once he was allowed to turn heel and aligned with Paul Heyman and wasn't doing these god-awful promos that were scripted for him and written out for him by Vince McMahon. And, you know, once he turned that corner, once the heel turn came, it was a totally different Roman Reigns than we had seen on television. Night and day. Imagine if we had gotten heel Roman Reigns years earlier. I don't know that he would have been ready for it. I don't know that we would have had a run from him like we're having now had the heel turn taken place, let's say, in 2015 or 2016. Although he definitely waited way too long to pull the trigger on that. But it is safe to say that Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose went on to be, you know, very big deals. And when we look back, I think, on the history of the Shield, and we look back on factions in terms of the members of those factions who went on to become headliners and future Hall of Famers, the Shield is going to be right up there in the mix, in the conversation among the greatest of all time. The Shield was, they were, along with Bryan Danielson, back in his Daniel Bryan days, really what kept Monday Night Raw interesting for me as a viewer in 2013 and into 2014. Through all the authority stuff and all that, it was the matches that they were going out there and having on a weekly basis. It was the feud, however brief it was, with the Shield and the Wyatt family, where WWE struck gold. And I look back on that and I say to myself, man, you know, when I think of matches that should have happened at WrestleMania and never did, there are certain matches I think of. I think of Hulk Hogan against Ric Flair. I think of The Rock and Triple H, who were supposed to wrestle in 2000 at WrestleMania, but Austin, you know, wasn't ready to come back and be in The Rock's corner, so they pushed it back by a month. But it's crazy to me how that was never a WrestleMania main event. And I also look at the Shield and the Wyatt family and I say, man, you know, 2014 WrestleMania in New Orleans, that would have been the time to do it instead of what they ended up doing. But that's one of those what if things. But I have a lot of positive memories of the Shield and plenty of podcasts for you to go back and listen to prove how big of a Shield fan I was. Anyway, 10 years of the Shield in WWE, and we see how they have taken over in the top two companies in the country right now. Now let's talk about Full Gear. Full Gear last night in Newark was the company's fourth straight pay-per-view with a live gate of over $1 million, their fifth one this year. And that is important because Full Gear tickets did not go on sale until the end of September. That was after the Brawl Out scrum with CM Punk. They sold this show without the benefit of CM Punk or people thinking that he would be there, which he wouldn't have been anyway because he's hurt. He was the one who helped get them to their first $1 million gate. So it's a good sign that they could still get there even without him around. And it was exactly the kind of show that AEW needed at exactly the time that they needed it. It has been a time of crisis for this company in many ways. Even though they did $1 million gate last night, you know, coming out of the fight and the suspensions and TV ratings softening a little bit, low ticket advances in a lot of places, and some of the new markets they're trying to break into, they needed to hit the reset button, not the panic button. And they did that last night. It felt like that's what they did. The show was still longer than it had to be. I say it every time. They do not need to be that long. but I thought it was an excellent show overall with only a couple of matches that I would consider bad. We had MJF beating Jon Moxley in the main event with an assist from William Regal. I saw this coming weeks ago. It played out exactly the way I envisioned it, slipping the brass knucks to MJF. He didn't use the Dynamite Diamond Ring, but he never said nothing about not using the knucks. And he is now the AEW World Champion, 26 years old. As Tony Schiavone said last night, 7 years in the business, and now on top of the world in AEW land. This is now the beginning of the MJF era. I thought the match did get overbooked at the end with the couple of ref bumps that they did, but it all built to the spot with Regal reaching into the ring and sliding the knucks to MJF. And then when the match was over and they cut to Regal up on stage, flashing a smirk and flashing kind of an approving nod at MJF, which poses the question now, what the relationship, if any, is going to be now going forward with MJF and William Regal. MJF is not somebody who needs a manager. He does not need somebody out there with him. He had Wardlow for the longest time, which kind of made sense because when you're the heel in the role that he was in, pissing people off, you know, it makes sense that you have a guy who's twice as big as you that you kind of hide behind, who watches your back. That's not what William Regal is, though. So MJF does not need William Regal. That does not mean, though, that I would not love to see William Regal in MJF's corner. And I would even, I mentioned CM Punk. Look back to 2012 when CM Punk turned heel. Raw 1000, he turned heel on The Rock. He ended up aligning with Paul Heyman. You're going to tell me that CM Punk needed Paul Heyman by his side? That he needed Paul Heyman to cut promos for him? Of course not. CM Punk is one of the best promo guys in the business in the last 15 years. He didn't need Paul Heyman, but they made a great combo on TV, and I think the same thing could apply here with MJF and Regal. It doesn't bode very well, I think, for the future of the Blackpool Combat Club. Wheeler Yuta came out, he called Regal a snake. I don't know how long those guys are going to stick together for. But this felt like the dawning of a new era for this company, and it was absolutely the right move to make. The time was now. Jon Moxley was not supposed to be the AEW World Champion right now. CM Punk was going to be the AEW World Champion, and it would have been CM Punk in Newark, putting over MJF last night. Jon Moxley, they just needed somebody who they could depend on and they could rely on to get the title to MJF and pass the baton to their young pillar, really their youngest pillar of the company. We talk about young pillars, we talk about Jungle Boy and Darby Allin and Sammy Guevara, some people talk about Dante Martin. I don't see him being a world champion or anything like that. Ricky Starks, you could throw him on the list. But MJF is at the top of that mountain. Sky's the limit for what this kid could do. He's got it all. He can work. He can talk. He can piss people off. But I also think he'll be a big-time babyface when the time is right. Now is not that time. He's got all the tools and all the attributes that you would look for in somebody who is going to be your top babyface or top heel in your company. He has now ascended to the throne. Tony Khan has given him the keys to the castle, and now it's up to him to see what he can do. Now, at the media scrum after the show, he stormed into the room, and he interrupted Tony Khan, who was answering questions. He cut a very intense, very profane promo on everybody. And before all the Punk defenders start comparing this to what Punk did, how is this different? This was clearly in character. And he said that AEW now is once again must-see destination TV. He said this belt now is the most important belt in the entire sport. And he said to everybody in the room, he goes, God damn, you people are fucking dumb. You had sympathy for the devil? What are you, fucking stupid? He said, you morons bit on every single word that I had to say the last couple of months. Oh, I want to earn it. He said, fuck that. I deserve it because I'm the best wrestler in the world. And every single one of you know it. On the mic, in the ring, nobody can touch me. And then to think that you guys still believe me when I put over this motherfucker, he was pointing at Tony Khan, that I put him over on Wednesday. He goes, grow the fuck up. Then he looked at Tony and said, no offense. So then he was talking. He said, oh, MJF, what's going on with you and Regal? You know, how did this all come about? And he said, you know, basically, you're going to have to wait. You're going to have to wait and watch the MJF show on TBS this Wednesday. He said, I'm going to go take a shower now. I'm going to get all the Moxley hepatitis off of me, hepatitis A through Z. And then in the morning, I'm going to go do what nobody else on the roster does because I'm the only real fucking star here. I'm going to hop on a jet and I'm going to go to my movie set. Then he asked anybody if they had questions. One guy put his hand up. He goes, just kidding. Thank you. Fuck you. Bye. Throwing in a little cornet there at the end. So MJF was MJF on full display last night. And if there was any wonder or debate about whether or not they were actually turning him babyface, now that could all be put to rest. There'll be a time for that. Now is not that time. We have a brand new interim AEW Women's Champion. Her name is Jamie Hayter. She and Toni Storm went out there and had the best match that either one of them have had in their entire run so far in AEW in front of what was very clearly a very pro-Jamie Hayter crowd, as most of the crowds have been for the last few months. Even though she's been coming out with Britt Baker, who's the top heel in the women's division, the people love Jamie Hayter. They love Jamie Hayter. They love her. Her style in the ring, she's stiff. She's got one of the best ripcord lariats in the business. Tony Khan mentioned during the media call, I don't know if he mentioned it on the scrum last night, but he did mention it on the media call he had a few days ago about the Thunder Rosa situation, not knowing when she may be back. And he said, look, I'm open to the possibility of Thunder Rosa. I'm giving her every opportunity that I can, but I'm open to the possibility of stripping her of the AEW Women's Championship and making the interim champion, whoever that may be after Full Gear, the permanent champion. I don't know when he would make that decision. Thunder Rosa has said that she hopes to be back in January. But this whole, you know, the interim title stuff, they already did it with the AEW title. Then they did it again with the women's title. Even if Tony Khan didn't know how long Thunder Rosa would be out for, how many interim champions are we supposed to have? Just put the interim champion nonsense to bed. Make Jamie Hayter the AEW Women's Champion, and when Tony, Thunder Rosa rather, is ready to come back, she can challenge for the title that she never lost. You don't need to do champion against champion, unification, all that stuff. Been there, done that. Just make Jamie Hayter the champion, Thunder Rosa can take her time, and when she's ready to come back, whether it's January, February, March, whenever it may be, March is going to be 1 year since she won the title in the cage match in San Antonio from Britt Baker. You can build to her getting a rematch for her title. But I loved the match last night between the two of them. I thought it was great. We have the return of the Elite, Kenny Omega, the Young Bucks. Love their entrance coming out to Kansas, Carry On, Wayward Son. They made their big return for the first time since All Out when they won the Trios titles, and then they were promptly stripped of those Trios titles. And as soon as Kenny Omega and Pac locked up, the crowd started a loud fuck CM Punk chant. And then there was some light Colt Cabana chant. So the crowd in Newark made it very clear whose side they were on. I don't know that the crowd will be as favorable on Wednesday when they're in Chicago. They're going to be in enemy territory this week. But they had an excellent match, as you would expect to have with Death Triangle. I mean, look who you had in this match. Omega, the Bucks, Rey Fénix, Pac, Penta. Right? I mean, six of the best they have on that roster. They let them go out there and do their thing. They had an excellent match with a very surprising finish that I was not expecting. And I actually love the finish of this match. We've seen the story play out on television now for many, many weeks. Pac was winning match after match when he was the All-Atlantic champion with the ring bell hammer. He was hitting people with it. Death Triangle, it was this interesting dynamic where Pac would cheat to win. Rey Fénix did not want to cheat to win. And multiple times he refused to use the hammer when Pac handed it to him. And they played that story out again last night. And again, Rey Fénix did not want to use the hammer. But in the end, when he was up for the One-Winged Angel and he realized he had nowhere to go and he had no choice, Pac had handed the hammer back to him and said, use it. And he did. He whacked Omega in the head with it and Kenny Omega took the losing fall. Death Triangle, still the Trios champs, and I love it. I love that finish. It keeps Death Triangle in the mix for at least a little while longer. Those guys are too good to be put on the back burner. But I love the story where Fénix held out as long as he could, but finally he realized, you know what, the guy's right. You do what you gotta do. Pac was so proud of him. He looked like a proud papa when this match was over. Go, see, I told you. So they're still the Trios champs, and they have since announced a best-of-seven series with these two teams. This was match number one. Match number two in the best of seven will take place in Chicago this Wednesday. And then there's a whole schedule of matches to follow. It does feel like overkill, but you know, like I said last night, I'm not going to sit here and complain about the fact that we're going to get more matches with these guys. Maybe by the time we get to match number three, match number four, you know, it'll be tiresome. I'll be sick of it, but they had such a great match last night. I can't complain about the fact that we're going to get it again. It is a little weird, though, because you would think they would build to the Elite getting the belts back. And now when you do a best of seven, usually that lends itself to kind of playing hot potato with the belts and trading it back and forth, you know, which is what may end up happening here, which I think kind of takes, I don't know, it feels to me like it kind of takes the punch away a little bit from when the Elite do get the belt, which they will, when they do get the belts back. But that has been announced. We'll get match number two on Wednesday. Saraya returned to the ring with a clean win over Britt Baker after 5 years away from the ring. And really, if you think about it, it was 6 years. After 6 years away from the ring, because she was out for over a year when she had neck surgery back in 2016. And she was only back a few weeks when Sasha Banks kicked her in the back. So really, it's more like 6 years that she's been away. You can understand there being some ring rust or some hesitation on her part, maybe to try certain things. It was her first match back. I thought she looked fine. She got through the first one. That's the most important thing. You know, there's going to be more. I don't know how often she'll be wrestling. I know she said her doctor said do one a month to start out with and see how your body holds up. So that was the most important thing, to make sure that she came out of the match unscathed, and she did. She came out of the match fine. But it was a very flat match. And why was it a very flat match? It was a very flat match. In large part, I blame the booking. They had Britt Baker, who has been the top heel in their women's division, cut a babyface promo on Wednesday night, positioning this as basically the WWE girl coming in and trying to take her spot and invade AEW and trying to show up AEW's top homegrown female star. Like, us against them. It's a very odd booking decision by Tony Khan. The story should have just been the comeback of Saraya. Saraya made it very clear she wanted to come to AEW. She saw that, you know, everybody was coming to AEW. Everybody loved it. Everybody was having, well, not everybody, but everybody was having fun. She wanted to join in, and she wanted to come back in an AEW ring. I mean, it was such a simple story to tell, and instead they decided to blur the lines, and we ended up with half the crowd last night chanting DMD. That is when they actually decided to make any noise at all. So that was a booking blunder on the part of Tony Khan, which I think hurt the match. I mean, the match itself wasn't great, but I wasn't expecting a knockdown dragout with a woman who hasn't wrestled in so long. But the booking, I think, really sabotaged the match in a big way last night. We had a Ring of Honor four-way for the World Championship. That was excellent. Chris Jericho retains the ROH title. No surprise there. He is now going to defend against Tomohiro Ishii of New Japan Pro Wrestling this Wednesday, who once held the Ring of Honor television title. Hence why he can challenge Jericho in his little open challenge. Samoa Joe is the new TNT champion. He won the title over Wardlow and Powerhouse Hobbs in a triple threat match. Now he has two belts. He's Joe two belts. He's got the ROH TV belt and he's got the TNT belt, which is basically AEW's version of a TV title. And so now we wait and see what they do with him at Final Battle, which is the last Ring of Honor pay-per-view of the year. It's coming up in less than a month. My impression when this was over was it made me wonder if the idea was they only put the belt on Joe just so they could do a singles match with Joe and Wardlow at Final Battle and then have Wardlow take the belt back there. And is that the only reason that we even saw a title change last night? I don't like how they fed Powerhouse Hobbs into this match just to be the sacrificial lamb, which is what happened. You know, he was in that match to take the losing fall. Whereas, at first, it looked like they were going to do a singles match between Wardlow and Powerhouse Hobbs, which I was all for, you know, and even if Hobbs lost, he could have gone in there and they could have really shined a spotlight on him. And I just kind of feel like he was playing second fiddle to what was going on with Wardlow and Samoa Joe last night. But they had a very enjoyable match. The Acclaimed are still the AEW Tag Team Champions. They beat Swerve and Our Glory, who are now, it looks like, officially split. Swerve wanted Keith Lee to use a pair of pliers. Keith Lee said no. He got slapped. Keith Lee left his partner to die. And the Acclaimed retained their titles. Jungle Boy over Luchasaurus, I thought was as good of an opener as we have ever seen on an AEW pay-per-view. It was violent. It was bloody. We got the big finish with Jungle Boy delivering the Shawn Michaels elbow from the top of the cage through a table. And he got the submission and the snare traps. And not only did he get the big elbow off the top, he got the big guy to tap out to his finishing hold. So they put Jungle Boy over very strong in this match. Now we wait to see when Christian Cage can come back. Because they're still going to want to circle back to this match. But Christian is probably going to be out for a few more months. So now it's just a matter of what do you do with Jungle Boy in the meantime. This is a big win for him. It's kind of like Ricky Starks beating Powerhouse Hobbs at Grand Slam. And then he vanished. This is the sort of thing where you want to keep the momentum going for Jungle Boy. So they have to vault him into something else. I don't know offhand what that would be. If the plan is to keep the TNT title on Samoa Joe for a while, a Samoa Joe Jungle Boy program for the TNT Championship, I think could be a lot of fun. Ricky Starks, I mentioned him. He beat Brian Cage on the pre-show. He is going to face Ethan Page this Wednesday on Dynamite in the finals of the Eliminator Tournament. The winner of that match will go on to challenge MJF for the AEW World title at Winter is Coming next month. I have no doubt in my mind it's going to be Ricky Starks. It should be Ricky Starks. Wardlow would make sense as an opponent for MJF, either at Revolution or Double or Nothing next year, given how badly he beat him in their last match. Wardlow can easily come out and say, look, Max, I got a win over you. If anybody deserves a shot at that championship, it's me. I've proven that I can beat you. Double or Nothing, now that I say that out loud, Double or Nothing makes even more sense. Because they can play off of it being 1 year since Wardlow pinned him. It was Double or Nothing this year when he beat him. Why not run it back at Double or Nothing next year? Only this time, it's for the World Championship. But we are now in a situation where we have a lot. Not every champion in this company is what you would call homegrown. But you've got MJF as the World Champion. Jamie Hayter as the Women's Champion. The Acclaimed are the Tag Team Champions. Orange Cassidy is the All-Atlantic Champion. And Jade Cargill, who's been this project for them as they develop her, is still the TBS champion. You know, all leading this company into 2023. They don't have the momentum they did earlier this year. A lot of that momentum that AEW had is gone. But they need to look at this, I think, as a fresh start. Use this as a launching pad into the new year. Because when this year is over, you're going to turn the page on 2022. CM Punk is not going to be with this company anymore. He's gone. Okay, whether he may not officially be gone yet, but basically CM Punk is gone. So you turn the page on that. You look ahead. You start fresh. Break into new markets. They're going to be running the UK for the first time next year. Ring of Honor. We'll see if Tony Khan gets his wish for a weekly show, and then maybe we can start to see less Ring of Honor stuff on the AEW shows. But to me, this was the reset that this company desperately needed. Now, the rest of the media scrum was pretty uneventful compared to the last one. Tony Khan addressed the status of Miro and Andrade. I feel like I get asked about Miro every single week, and I don't have a good answer. Where is Miro? How come Miro is not on TV? I don't know. Ask Tony Khan. Well, somebody did ask Tony Khan. And Tony Khan said that when he started AEW, he said that he wanted a big roster and that he wasn't committing to everybody necessarily working every single week or working people, you know, in and out of the cards. And that's still something he says that he's committed to. So if people aren't at every single event, he says that he would like to see them get involved. He said that we have seen people take sabbaticals and breaks from AEW. You know, Miro was gone for a while to film a role on a TV show, but that was a while ago. So he said, you know, we've seen that from people before. They take breaks, they step away for a while, but can still be very involved. And he thinks that is still potentially something that you could see for both of those guys. He thinks both of them are great, and he would like to see both of them involved in the future. The reality is, Tony Khan is the one who books the shows. He's the boss. If he wanted them on TV, they would be there. We know why Andrade is not at TV right now. I'm talking more Miro than Andrade. But if he wanted them there, they would be there. People don't need to be on the show every single week. I agree. You can rotate them in and out. But with Miro, it feels like they rotated him out and they forgot to unlock the door and let him back in. He said that there has been communication between himself and Hangman Page and Adam Cole. But he gave no update on their returns, which is hard to do when it comes to concussions. Meltzer in The Observer this week said there's a lot of people very concerned behind the scenes about Adam Cole, given how long he's been out for. He hasn't wrestled since June at Forbidden Door, which is where he got hurt. That's concerning, but until somebody says something, nobody knows for sure what the update is. Adam Cole is on Twitch, I think, almost every day, right? Chugs. So he's on Twitch, I mean, look, you have people who have bad concussions and they can't even look at a computer screen or a television screen for more than a few minutes at a time. You know, the light might give them terrible migraines. I mean, there's reasons to be positive and say that Adam Cole looks to be okay, but we don't know. We don't know what he's going through. We don't know what other symptoms he may be dealing with, if there are lingering symptoms. Maybe he feels just fine, but for whatever reason, AEW just isn't ready to clear him yet. But it's been a long time. And so I can understand why people would be concerned. The most important thing, though, is to make sure that he's healthy. Concussions are no joke. Concussions can be career-ending. And I would hate for that to be the case with Adam Cole. If that means he has to take another 6 months off before he comes back, then so be it. But because we're not getting a lot of information, it just allows people to, you know, speculate and their imagination runs rampant. And the first thing you do is you go to the negative and you think, well, it's been so long. This is terrible. What's going on here? Tony Khan said that he has considered different options for a weekly Ring of Honor show, like putting it on YouTube, but he thinks it deserves something better than that. And he is still optimistic about getting a weekly Ring of Honor television show. I'm still optimistic that I'll hit the Powerball jackpot. That doesn't mean that there's a good chance of that happening. So that's where things stand on the ROH front. And this didn't come up at the scrum, but I did want to make mention of it. After his match on Dynamite, where he tagged up with Top Flight against Death Triangle, AR Fox has been offered an AEW contract. He had worked half a dozen matches on Dark before that, but that was really his first big match in AEW. That was his first time on Dynamite. He was backstage after their loss. He was being interviewed by Lexi Nair, and she sprung the news on him. I'm just getting word that Tony Khan has officially offered you an AEW contract. And he looked like he was in shock. He was trying to process the news. You know, here's a guy, he's 35 years old. He has worked almost everywhere, but the very top promotions. He hasn't been in WWE or before this in AEW, but he's worked a little bit with Impact, CZW, Evolve, PWG. He had the run as Dante Fox on Lucha Underground. He's very highly regarded from what I can gather as a trainer. He runs his own school, I think, with his wife. I know he trained Austin Theory, for example. He might just be content to train people and just focus on his school and his students, but he is somebody who should have gotten his big break somewhere, and he never did. And I know there's a reason why WWE probably never looked at him, and it's bullshit. I think he at least deserved a look. So I am glad that Tony Khan is giving him a chance. Maybe he could use AEW as a foot in the door for his students, but I'm happy to see him at least getting the opportunity. I said that overnight there was more news. Earlier this morning, New Japan and Stardom held their joint crossover show, and after his successful IWGP US title defense against Shota Umino, Will Ospreay was greeted by a video message from Kenny Omega, challenging him to a match for the U.S. title at the Tokyo Dome January 4th at Wrestle Kingdom. So January 1st, we've got Shinsuke Nakamura wrestling the Great Muta at the Pro Wrestling Noah show. And 3 days later, we get Ospreay and Omega at the Tokyo Dome. Omega was sitting on a golden throne. He was speaking mostly in Japanese. He was saying that Ospreay replaced him. When he left New Japan, he blamed Ospreay for the smaller crowds and the lack of crowd cheering. He said people blame the pandemic for that, but there's another virus that's responsible for that, and that's Will Ospreay. So Ospreay accepted the challenge. It sucks that they still won't allow crowd cheering, although Kevin Kelly made a comment sort of teasing that there might be some noise made at the Dome. I hope so. I really hope so. I mean, I just think it's silly at this point, you know, because in certain buildings they were allowing it. So some buildings it's okay, in other buildings it's not. Like, it just doesn't make sense. But there's your early match of the year right there. And the year hasn't even started yet. This is going to be Omega's first match in a New Japan ring in 4 years since Wrestle Kingdom 13, where he dropped the IWGP belt to Tanahashi on his way out. Also this morning, Kairi, the former Kairi Sane from WWE, defeated Mayu Iwatani, as I figured she would, to become the first ever IWGP Women's Champion. Kairi has a bigger name in the U.S. than Iwatani does, so if they want to tour with that belt in the States, which was kind of the whole point of them creating this belt in the first place, and they want to have it defended on New Japan Strong, Kairi was the better person to put the belt on. After the match, Tam Nakano came out, challenged Kairi to a title match at Wrestle Kingdom. So that's going to be the first ever IWGP Women's Championship match inside the Tokyo Dome. That'll be on January 4th. Yeah, I'm getting excited. It's almost that time of year. This just reminds me that it's almost that time of year. We've got the Dome show coming up, which is always great. And now this year they're back to the one night. So I'm kind of hoping it's not 6 hours long, but we have the Dome show. We're finally getting some big AEW names on that show. FTR is going to be defending their titles, the IWGP belts at the Tokyo Dome as well. Against who, we don't know yet. And then it's Royal Rumble season a few weeks later. And that leads right into WrestleMania. And speaking of WrestleMania, Stone Cold Steve Austin. We are getting close to Mania season, so you're going to be hearing that name a lot more. It was WrestleVotes in talking to Louis Dangor of Give Me Sport a few weeks ago who first floated the possibility that Austin could come back for another match. He said how happy Austin was with the way things went with Kevin Owens this year and how people in the company that he heard from thought that he would definitely be open to the idea of doing another match. Now we learn from Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful that WWE has been in contact with Austin about another match. This is no longer a what-if scenario. They have made contact with the man about wrestling again. They were told that while the Vince McMahon regime had hoped to have Austin come back to do another match, the Triple H regime made a concrete offer for him to come back and do one. Their sources were not sure if that meant Saudi Arabia or if it meant WrestleMania, but I mean, the presumption is that it would be for WrestleMania. It's got to be WrestleMania. You've got two nights of WrestleMania in April. You're not holding Stone Cold Steve Austin out of WrestleMania to use him on a Saudi Arabia show in May. If he is coming back, it is going to, at least initially, it's going to be for WrestleMania. Now, another source indicated to Fightful that initially the two sides were far apart on terms, and that is the latest update that they had. Dave Meltzer said that there is smoke to the fire on the Austin stuff, so he backs up those reports. Austin, for his part, chimed in because he has not said anything about any of it. And these rumors started weeks ago. He has not chimed in. He has not said anything. But he chimed in on Instagram yesterday. And this is what he said. He posted a video and he was showing his workout routine. He was about to go work out. And he said, people have been speculating. Hey, Steve, what are you doing? What are you training for? Are you training for an event? He said, speculate what you want for. I just simply looked in the mirror and realized I look like shit. So I called my diet coach up and my macros are currently give or take roughly around 2,600 calories, 300 to 320 grams of protein, 150 grams of carbs on a regular day, will spike at 420 on a load up. I still drink beer on Friday nights, get 3 Broken Skull IPAs, and that's pretty much it. I'm probably, as far as body weight goes, sub 232, the leanest I've been in forever. Anyway, that's the bottom line. I'm out. I just got tired of looking like shit. When I looked in the mirror, I looked like shit. I got tired of it, so I'm taking actions to do something about it. And that's great. If somebody looks in the mirror and thinks they look like shit, then they should do something about it. But I heard what he said there. 320 grams of protein. Holy shit. 320 grams of protein is more than just, I thought I looked like shit. This man is getting himself in shape for more than just the mirror in his gym. He didn't deny it. He said, speculate if you want. I mean, look, I've been speculating about things for the past 15 years. I'm not about to stop now. Like I said before, when I look at the current active WWE roster, the man who I think would be the best fit for a feud with Steve Austin would be LA Knight. We saw a little bit of that on SmackDown Friday night in the segment that he did with Bray Wyatt. If they wanted to go the route of giving somebody some rub by working with Austin, he may not be the flashiest opponent or the sexiest opponent for Austin, but it is someone who could verbally joust with him on the mic. And I want to say something about this, because a lot of people gave me crap when I said this last week. So this is only directed at those people. Okay, I'm going to do my best Zoe Stark impression from NXT this week. I'm going to cut my own You People promo here. You people seem to forget that in 1996, there was a man by the name of Steve Austin. And this man was floundering. First, he was the ringmaster. He was on the road to nowhere. Then he changed his name to Stone Cold. He dumped Ted DiBiase. He won the King of the Ring. He cut that iconic Austin 316 speech. And then, nothing. Nothing. He wrestled Yokozuna in the pre-show match at SummerSlam that year. A lot of people think that he cut that promo and it launched him into the stratosphere. It didn't. What elevated him is when he started calling out Bret the Hitman Hart. Here's Steve Austin, a guy who had done next to nothing in that company, calling out one of the biggest stars in the entire promotion. And Bret ended up working with him twice, once at Survivor Series and again at WrestleMania, even if that wasn't the original plan. He gave Austin the biggest break of his career. Austin will be the first one to tell you that, how big it was for his career to work that program with Bret Hart. There's no reason they couldn't work a similar angle with LA Knight, calling Austin out on television in the months leading up to WrestleMania, angling to get him back in the ring for one more match. There are bigger names for him to work against. All I'm saying is it is not as far-fetched as some people may think. Kevin Owens was fantastic this year. He carried that entire storyline because Austin never showed up on television once. He sent in a video. That was it. Kevin Owens was cutting promos on himself every week. But if WWE wants to go for the biggest possible attraction they can for Steve Austin, yeah, I know people are fantasy booking a match with CM Punk, 10 years too late. That would have been fantastic in 2011 and 2012, 10 years too late. I would be more worried if Punk could hold up physically more than I would Austin, given how injury prone he's turned out to be this year. There was a note in this week's Observer that Punk's rehab for the torn triceps is said to be going really well. That's still an injury that I think would make WrestleMania very unlikely. And even if he was cleared, if he was physically cleared to compete, he is still under contract to AEW. I just cannot imagine Tony Khan buying him out or letting him go without some sort of non-compete that would at least get them past WrestleMania. So, fantasy book all you want, Steve Austin is not wrestling CM Punk at WrestleMania. Another Steve Austin Rock match? That would be fun. I will never get tired of Stone Cold and The Rock, and it hasn't been done in 20 years. But they're both 20 years older than they were the last time we saw them in the ring together. And the only match, and I've said this before, I'll keep saying it, the only match that Rock is coming back for if he ever wrestles again is against Roman Reigns. You don't have to like the match. You don't have to approve of it. The mere thought of it might bore you to tears. If The Rock does come back to wrestle again next year, the year after, he is only coming back for a match with Roman Reigns. He's not going to come back and wrestle Steve Austin. Plus, if you can get Rock and Austin back, you don't feud them with each other. You get two big matches out of it instead of one. You got two nights of WrestleMania. You headline each night, one with The Rock and one with Steve Austin. Brock Lesnar's name has been thrown around. Are these people out of their minds? Of all the people to put almost 60-year-old Steve Austin in the ring with a bad neck, you're going to put him in the ring with the German suplex machine? That leaves one name, and that's John Cena. The battle of the Attitude Era and the PG Era. The PG Era is where Cena cemented himself as a Hall of Famer, not the Ruthless Aggression Era, which is why I said the PG Era. I can see the appeal in Austin against Cena. and Cena's a much safer opponent for Austin than Brock Lesnar would be. If they headline night one with Roman Reigns and The Rock, and night two with Austin and Cena, yeah, obviously that would be huge. I say Rock and Roman on night one just because I would expect Roman to win. And do they really want Roman Reigns as the heel to close out the final night of WrestleMania 3 years in a row? If it's for the title, then yes. But otherwise, I think they could get by headlining night two with something else. Now, though, Logan Paul has thrown his name in the hat for a match with John Cena at WrestleMania. We don't even know if John Cena is working a match at WrestleMania. And he already has three potential opponents in Steve Austin, Logan Paul, and Austin Theory. Logan Paul said that he has already texted Triple H about it. And he asked Triple H, are you ready to break the internet again? So he's hurt right now. He had to cancel a boxing fight that he had scheduled for January. The only thing he said about the knee injury is that it could have been worse. His brother Jake Paul spilled the beans and said that his brother's rehab is going better than expected because it turned out to be an MCL and a meniscus injury only. It's not an ACL tear as they had initially feared it might be. And that's the key. If he tore his ACL, he would be out of WrestleMania. Without an ACL tear, it makes it more likely that he can work the show. I don't hate the idea, because he had that great match with Roman Reigns at Crown Jewel. I think he and John Cena would kill it, but I think Logan Paul against somebody like Randy Orton, and we don't know what his future is, but an Orton or a Seth Rollins, I think that would be the way to go for WrestleMania. But to go back to Stone Cold, he got through the match with Kevin Owens. He even took a suplex in the crowd on the concrete, and he made it out in one piece without getting hurt. Austin has been posting, you know, these videos on Instagram of himself training. He has not come out and denied any of this. So it comes down to how big of an offer are they willing to make him? How badly does WWE need Steve Austin when they have already sold over 100,000 tickets between both nights of WrestleMania? That was in the span of a week. In August, they sold 100,000 tickets in August for two shows that don't take place until April, and they did it without a single match or a single name being announced for either night. They don't need Austin for that show, so are they willing to spend extra to get him? Time will tell. You know, the last Fightful heard about this, the two sides were far apart on terms, but a lot can happen between now and then. But now is the time for him to start getting back in ring shape if he wants to get back in the ring. So it's not a surprise to see him on Instagram doing squats to Earth, Wind, and Fire. Actually, Earth, Wind, and Fire was a surprise. Not the squats. See, Austin in his 30s, he came to the ring to Disturbed. Austin at almost 60 should come to the ring to Earth, Wind, and Fire. It actually does make sense. Let's get some Boogie Wonderland playing at WrestleMania next year. There are two former WWE stars. Really, one of them was an NXT star. The other one I would barely call a WWE star because she made exactly one appearance on the main roster. But they look to be on their way back to the company. Chelsea Green and Bronson Reed, who's currently wrestling as Jonah for New Japan Pro Wrestling. Dave Meltzer cannot confirm that she has put pen to paper yet, but Chelsea Green appears to be done with Impact. She just finished up with Impact Wrestling, and the belief is that she is on her way in. I've been reading rumors about Matt Cardona also. Any offer that's been made to him, that nobody seems to know, but that there is interest on the WWE side possibly in bringing Zack Ryder back to the company. Nothing solid, though, on that front, but as far as Chelsea goes, it was just one bad break, literally, after another for this woman. First it was the left wrist, then it was the right one, I think. Her first night in on SmackDown 2 years ago, she was in a fatal four-way match. She was supposed to win to qualify for a spot on the women's Survivor Series team, but she broke her wrist again. And then a few months later, she was released. So hopefully she can stay healthy and contribute, because that women's roster, especially on the SmackDown side, could really use her right now. Now, Meltzer says Jonah has been offered a contract, whereas with Chelsea Green, we don't know exactly what the status is. With Jonah, he has been offered a contract to return to the company, and the ball is in his court. You know, he's got a good thing going on right now with New Japan. He was a Triple H guy back when he was in NXT, so it's no surprise that Triple H would want him back. They called him up for a tryout match and never did anything with him. So it was very clear that Vince McMahon didn't want the guy. And I know he wasn't very happy with what John Laurinaitis said to him the day he got that phone call giving him his release. Well, they're both gone now. There is no more Vince McMahon. There is no more Johnny Ace. And Triple H is the one running creative. Now would be the time. If he has any aspirations of going back to WWE, and I'm sure he does, now is the time to jump at the chance. There's no bad choice. You know, he could go back to WWE or he could continue working in New Japan for another year and build up his name some more. But if he wants to end up in WWE and they have interest in him already, or they've made an offer to him, what do you need to build your name up for anymore? You've already built it up enough. They want you now. In a year, they may not want you. And he got a raw deal when they cut him. I would like to see him go back and prove what he can do. And I trust that this time under Triple H, he'll get that chance. So I'd like to see him end up back in WWE. I did not do a live Raw review this week because I ended up getting out late from a doctor's appointment. Then I hit the evening rush. So there was some colorful language flying around that car on the ride home. But if ever there was a night to miss a stream, that was it. It was a very dull show on Monday. I think the honeymoon may be over. You have a 3-hour show, and you fill it with matches involving Dolph Ziggler, Tamina, Akira Tozawa, Dana Brooke, Shelton Benjamin. I mean, to use one or two of them like they did to get over somebody else, fine. To throw them all on the same show just made it feel like one of those marathon superstars or wrestling challenge tapings they used to do years ago, where they were just filled with nothing but job matches for 4 hours. You could throw Mustafa Ali in there too, because that's pretty much all that he is at this point. He got killed by Bobby Lashley. What do all of those names that I just mentioned, by the way, have in common? They're all booked like losers on television. And that's what Raw was filled with on Monday night. It was filled with losers. And that makes for a very boring night of television. Heading into what should be a very exciting Survivor Series. It got 2 War Games matches. And up until we got to SmackDown on Friday, I wasn't feeling the excitement. So, you know, people talk about Full Gear having a lackluster build this year. What the hell do you call this? But then at least with SmackDown and what they did at the end of the show, that helped turn things around. But that sucks because I've been waiting for them to bring War Games to the main roster now for years. And, you know, up until Friday night, I'm just sitting here thinking, man, this is it. We're basically a week away from this pay-per-view. And there's no real reason to get excited. There was a lot of worry about Kevin Owens and wonder whether or not he would be able to even make the War Games match. He got hurt in a match in Wisconsin, a live event last weekend. He was at the Performance Center. He was said to be rehabbing. He wasn't moving around too well. You know, it would have been terrible for him not to be able to be part of that match. But as we'll get to SmackDown here in a second, we found out that all's well that ends well, as far as that goes. The transition from heel to babyface for Seth Rollins is complete, and I don't know where that leaves Cody Rhodes for WrestleMania if The Rock does come back to wrestle Roman Reigns. There's really no point in another match with Cody and Seth if Seth is going to be, you know, babyface from this point on. I would have it, you know, if that's the case, I would have it come down to the two of them in the Royal Rumble match with Cody going over, just to kind of put a button on that feud once and for all, and then you can move on from it. I mean, the last time we saw Cody on TV, he was taking a sledgehammer shot from Seth Rollins. I don't think that can go unpunished. So doing a spot at the end of the Royal Rumble with them is probably the best thing to do. Rollins successfully defended his United States Championship against Finn Balor before Austin Theory came out and he left him laying and he posed with the U.S. title to close out Monday Night Raw. A newly repackaged Austin Theory, now free of the poison briefcase that he's been carrying around for all those months. Boy, did they make him look like a geek last week. But now that he is rid of that thing, they can start all over with him. You talk about pushing the reset button in AEW, they can push the reset button now on Austin Theory. They did him no favors with how they booked that cash in. That was terrible. But this week, there were no selfies. There was no promo with, oh, I'm the youngest this, and oh, I'm the youngest that. They had him explain his rationale for cashing in on the U.S. title by him bringing up the fact that Roman Reigns has been unstoppable now for over 2 years, and that he knew that the bloodline would be there if he tried to cash in. He brought up the same thing that I did, that at SummerSlam, Brock Lesnar stopped him from cashing in, and that at Clash at the Castle, Tyson Fury stopped him from cashing in. So he decided that this was the path of least resistance, I guess. At least they tried. At least they tried to make it somewhat logical, even though he still had 7 months to cash that thing in. For all he knows, Roman Reigns could have lost the championship in the next 3 months. Even if Roman Reigns lost the championship at WrestleMania, he still would have had months to cash in. Or the biggest logic lapse of all, he could have guaranteed himself a main event match at WrestleMania without even having to win the Royal Rumble. But see, now I'm being too logical. The cash-in, though, is a thing of the past. What matters is how they rehab this guy going forward. They started on Monday by making him more of a serious threat. As Ewan tweeted to me, he said, Austin Theory finally hit puberty on Monday. He lost to Dolph Ziggler by DQ when Theory just snapped, and he gave him this brutal beatdown. Even multiple referees couldn't control him. Agents came out, they couldn't hold this guy back. Then he came out again after the main event. He did the same thing to Seth Rollins. This is the Austin Theory that could be a world champion for them one day. This is the Austin Theory that could be a money player for this company. Theory needed a strong bounce back after what they did to him the week before, and this was a good step in that direction. I cannot say the same for Mustafa Ali. It was more of the same with him on Monday. Not only does he keep losing, the fans are just completely apathetic towards him when he's out there. Even at the mere mention of his name on Monday, like, nobody cared. It wasn't until he got in the ring with Ricochet on Friday that finally changed. But you go back to Monday, when Seth Rollins mentioned his name at the start of the show, the crowd booed. They booed. And after Lashley hit him with a pair of spine busters, the crowd was so upset by this, they chanted, "One more time!" Ali had negative momentum heading into this World Cup match with Ricochet on Friday night. And I like Ali. I think he's a talented guy. I think there was a time years ago where he could have gotten over, but he got hurt and, you know, they sat him home for 7 months. We had the retribution stuff, and he just never recovered from that. Mia Yim has joined the babyface side on the women's War Games team with Bianca Belair, Asuka, and Alexa Bliss, with one spot left to fill. Rhea Ripley will take the fifth and final spot on the heel side with Bayley, Dakota Kai, Io Shirai, and Nikki Cross. Now that they have announced a singles match for Survivor Series with AJ Styles and Finn Balor, Rhea had no role on the show, so War Games made sense, although I don't know why she would trust being on the same team with Dakota Kai again after the stunt that Dakota pulled in their last War Games match together in NXT when she turned against her own team and beat up Tegan Knox. I guess that's a little too inside baseball for them to make reference to. But that puts Rhea and Mia on opposites. That's like Io and Mio, right? Her sister Mio Shirai. That puts Rhea and Mia on opposite sides. But it also puts Rhea and Bianca on opposite sides, which gives us a sneak peek of what should be the match at WrestleMania. Now, they're having a match on Raw tomorrow night with one member from each team to decide which team will have the advantage at War Games. It's going to be Asuka one-on-one with Rhea Ripley. This is going to be Rhea's first match on Raw since June 6th. She became the number one contender for the Raw Women's Championship that night, but she got hurt. That was the night that she kneed herself right in the teeth and had that, what they called a brain and teeth injury, which sounds, I mean, I've never heard an injury put that way before. I don't remember if that was something WWE said or if that was the way Meltzer put it, but a brain and teeth injury sounds pretty bad. And we never did get the match. It was supposed to be at Money in the Bank in Las Vegas. Rhea Ripley against Bianca Belair. We never got the match. Rhea wrestled Roxanne Perez on NXT last month. Before that, you'd have to go all the way back to May for the last singles match that she had on Monday Night Raw. So we'll get to see Rhea back in the ring tomorrow night. Now, on SmackDown, I mentioned turning a corner in terms of the build to War Games. Kevin Owens returned as the fifth man on the babyface side. He'll be partnering with Drew McIntyre, Sheamus, Butch Holland, and Ridge, or Ridge Holland. Butch, look at this. I'm creating new wrestlers now. Butch Holland and Ridge. No, it'll be Ridge Holland and Butch. And Kevin, you can tell I'm going on 4 hours sleep. You got to cut me some slack here, okay? I'm basically dead to the world here today. It's amazing I'm even doing a fucking show. So Kevin Owens is going to join the babyface squad. And it was this great finish where he came out and he got this big pop from the crowd and he ran wild on the bloodline. He gave Roman Reigns a stunner and everybody was very happy to see him, to the point where Owens went on Twitter and he thanked the fans. He thanked them for that great reaction and how happy they were to see him back. And you could tell that it meant a lot to him for him to get that reaction. And moving around out there, he looked fine. If he did hurt his knee, if he's got a sprain, obviously it wasn't that bad. Or, you know, he's just got a high pain tolerance, but he was moving around okay. In a match like War Games, you know, you're in there with 9 other guys. So if he's not 100%, there are ways that they can mask the injury. You know, they could beat him down and, you know, he could sell an injury. He could sell an injury to the leg, right? I mean, he doesn't have to do too much because it's not a one-on-one match. It's not a tag team match. There's going to be 10 men inside those two rings. So he's good to go. So we've got our field now set for the War Games match. And now all of a sudden I'm excited. Now we're less than a week away from War Games. And I'm excited to see what they come up with in that match. The man advantage in War Games is going to be determined this Friday with Drew McIntyre and Sheamus wrestling the Usos. I think the heels get the advantage in the women's match. And the babyfaces get the advantage in the men's match. Ricochet advance in the World Cup tournament with a win over Mustafa Ali. A much better reaction to Ali than he's been getting on Raw. They got the crowd into it. He's going to wrestle Braun Strowman this Friday. The Strowman Express is pulling into SmackDown Friday night to take on the flippy floppy Ricochet. Butch pinned Sami Zayn to advance to the next round. He'll take on Santos Escobar this Friday. I am picturing a final of Butch against Braun, with Braun winning the cup and going on to challenge Gunther for the Intercontinental title. You know, what they did on Friday night, they had a tag team match. Braun Strowman was the surprise partner with New Day against Imperium. And not once, not twice, but 3 different times in that match, they had Gunther running away, scared, from Braun Strowman. Now, I know they're trying to get Strowman over as the monster. And I know that when they finally do meet, if they go one-on-one, Gunther is going to probably win that. He better fucking win that match. He's probably going over in that match. So they want him to sell the fear that, oh, you know, he might have met his match in Braun Strowman, the one man that we've seen him run away from in WWE. I know what they're doing, but it looks so fucking dumb. He should not be running away. 3 times he ran away from this man. I hated that. Hated that. Bray Wyatt and LA Knight had a segment in the ring together. It was brief, but they've got a good rapport with each other. They're playing off each other very well. LA Knight is in this role as a heel is so great. You know, he's talking about how I saw in your eyes last week, I think you have respect for me. And they were going to have a handshake, and then he smacked him and he said, okay, now we're even. Right? You put me down with a headbutt last week. I had to get you back. Now we're even. And Bray Wyatt was willing to let it go, and then he ended up smacking him again and laughing at it and saying, boy, you're stupid. You're very dumb. So now Bray Wyatt is on the cusp of just losing his mind. He had this look on his face like he is battling the angel and the demon on his shoulder, the angel and the devil. He's trying to be a good Samaritan. He's trying to behave himself. And, you know, these external forces in the world are not allowing him to do so. And so one of these days, the Uncle Howdy portion of Bray Wyatt is going to come out. And these two are probably going to have a match at Survivor Series. So I'm enjoying this so far. It's the feud that I never expected, but I'm enjoying what they've done so far. Later in the show, LA, well, I almost called him LA Gear. LA Knight was found in the back. Remember, I used to have LA Gears back in the day. I think they were the ones that lit up on the sides. I had my pair of LA. I paired $84 it cost for my pair of LA gear back in the day. Great sneakers. But they found LA Knight laid out in the back. We don't know by who. We can pretty much figure out who. But I'm enjoying what they're doing with these two so far. Couple of news and notes. Chris Jericho recently had Lee Moriarty on his Talk is Jericho podcast, where Moriarty talked about doing a paper back in high school on whether pro wrestling should qualify as a sport, comparing it to gymnastics. He said gymnastics is a routine, just like pro wrestling is, and that's a sport. We're competing together as a team in the ring against other matches or whatever show might be running against us. It's a sport. We are athletes. Jericho then chimed in and said that one of his all-time goals is to literally go in front of the IOC, which is the International Olympic Committee, and pitch pro wrestling as an Olympic sport. He said, now, you might go, how can you do that? He says, hold on, stop right there. Gymnastics, pairs gymnastics, figure skating, pairs figure skating, what is that? It's two people working together to put on the best performance possible. Then the judges give you a score, and if you're a doubles figure skater, which is one of the top-rated sports in the Winter Olympics, America finished first, Russia second, Japan is third. There is no way we could not do the same thing with pro wrestling. An AEW wrestler comparing what they do to gymnastics is going to make some people's heads explode. I can picture it now, though. You know, Dave Meltzer sitting off to the side holding up seven stars for the Japanese team. This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. Nobody is denying that pro wrestlers are athletes. They absolutely are. They're some of the best athletes in the world. But it's not a real competition. The outcomes are predetermined. And even if you want to focus solely on what they're saying about it being a competition among the wrestlers to see who can have the better performance, now you're getting into the idea, well, what makes a good pro wrestling match? They're focusing on the physical aspect of what they do. And I guess just having a bunch of people cooperating to do a gymnastics routine and not even bothering with a finish. I guess you don't need finishes for these matches. That's not pro wrestling. Pro wrestling is not gymnastics. It's not just flips and dives and holds. The physical aspect is only one part of it. Pro wrestling is about story. It's about characters. It's about promos. How do you even begin to judge all of that as a real sport? One of the most important aspects of pro wrestling is crowd reaction and crowd engagement and the ability to sell tickets and fill seats. How does that get factored into things? Like in what he's proposing here, it doesn't. It doesn't even factor in. Pro wrestling combines elements of things that already have their own Olympic sports. You want flips and dives? Guess what? They already have the gymnastics competition. You want mat-based holds? Guess what? They already have wrestling in the Olympics. But you can't put it in a neat little box and call it any one of those things. So the whole concept to me is ludicrous. And I know they've had some ridiculous events at the Olympics over the years. They used to have pigeon shooting once upon a time. Just because you can point to other dumb Olympic sports does not mean that pro wrestling should be added to that list. I'll bet the drug testing would probably be fun though. Scotty Tuhati was trending on Twitter this week for what was supposedly a controversial tweet. I'm still looking for this controversial tweet. I've searched high and low. He was supposedly called out for a controversial tweet that wasn't controversial at all, which is why all the people who attacked him for it win the award for said tweet this week. When Scotty left the WWE Performance Center, he left NXT, he started taking bookings again independently. And this week, he tweeted a message to promoters looking to book him to do intergender wrestling matches. I guess he's been getting some offers for this. He said he's not going to do them because he has a 20-year-old daughter and, quote-unquote, hurting women is not something that appeals to him. He said, "Dear promoters, I do not fight," and he put that in quotes, "I do not fight women. I'm 49. I have a 20-year-old daughter. Hurting women is not appealing to me. I understand that there are men that do it these," and again, when he says hurting, it's important to point out he's putting that in quotation marks. He understands that, you know, they're not really hurting the women. But he said, "Hurting women is not appealing to me. I understand that there are men that do it these days. It's just not my thing. If that makes me old or out of touch, I'll take it. Please stop trying to book it. Also, before my matches from 20 plus years ago with Linda Miles in China or any other women are brought up, I know what I did. It was a different time, a different place. And I was not a father to a 20-year-old daughter." Nothing wrong with what he said there. He doesn't want to wrestle women. There's absolutely nothing controversial about that. But some people, if they had nothing to be offended about, they wouldn't know what to do with themselves. There are times to call people out for saying stupid shit. And then there are times to just let the man have his opinion on his own Twitter account. A couple of people called him out for even saying anything at all. Why bring it up? Why bring it up? Because he was getting offers to do it and he wanted to let promoters know that he wasn't interested. And by the way, it's his own fucking Twitter account. That's why. He wasn't being dismissive of it. He just said that it's not something that he feels comfortable with. Session Moth Martina, she tweeted that Scotty was asked to wrestle her earlier this year. And she said that he could not have been more polite when explaining his reasons not to do it. She said that she completely accepted and understood, and so they ended up teaming up as partners against two guys. And she said the match was great, and the whole experience was great. And she told people to just leave him alone. Well said. It's amazing what qualifies as controversial these days. Last night, I said that I didn't like the Jade Cargill-Nyla Rose match, and that I thought the Saraya-Britt Baker match was very flat. I had one person ask me, why do I have an agenda? Why do you have an agenda against women's wrestling? They asked me that question on the same show that I talked about Toni Storm and Jamie Hayter going out there and having one of the best matches of the night. They asked me that question. People hear what they want to hear. The wax suddenly forms in their ears when you say something that doesn't fit their narrative. So, Scotty Too Hotty, you keep doing your thing. To the people who came at him and tried to make something out of nothing, crack a window open and get some air. On NXT this week, Shawn Michaels announced two Iron Survivor Challenge matches for the NXT Deadline show on December 10th. One for the men, one for the women. So they lost War Games. This is their replacement, I guess. The rules for the Iron Survivor Challenge are as follows. They have five superstars competing in a 25-minute match. Two people begin. Every 5 minutes, a new one enters until all five have entered. The objective is to have the most falls at the end of the 25 minutes. And every winning fall counts as 1 point. So that means that the final entrant only has 10 minutes to get as many falls as possible, which hardly seems fair. When you lose a fall, you get put in a penalty box for 90 seconds. So basically, it's the old King of the Mountain match from TNA. Only this time, you don't have to take the championship and attach it to the hook above the ring. They had the reverse ladder match rules, which was always very dumb to me. If the old championship scramble had a one-night stand with the Iron Man match, this is what would pop out 9 months later. It sounds interesting enough. It makes sense to try these things out first in NXT, and then if they take off, eventually they could bring it to the main roster. It's like NXT is like one giant Petri dish for WWE. Had a championship match with Bron Breakker defending successfully his NXT championship against Von Wagner. I was pleasantly surprised. Did the match on TV, beat Wagner, and now Bron is moving on. He's moving on to Apollo Crews, most likely at the NXT Deadline show. We got the follow-up promo, the You People promo from Zoe Stark to explain her betrayal of Nikita Lyons at the end of last week's show. And she said that her back feels so much lighter now that she doesn't have to carry Nikita Lyons. And she talked about being on the shelf for 9 months with a knee injury. Said that she came out like a bat out of hell when she came back, earned a shot at the NXT Women's Championship. And then she said that she was called into a meeting all of a sudden where everything changed. They called her over to put her in a tag team with Nikita Lyons. And Stark said that she couldn't compete because she wasn't medically cleared. She said that Lyons showed up and told Stark that, oh, it's okay, and I'm not mad at you. And she said that she was being condescending, and I'm not the weak link. She talked about carrying her in the team, and all Nikita gave her was endless apologies instead of endless results. She said that she did her best to help a younger athlete out, but all she did was cling and leech off of her, and she said that she's sick and tired of this. She says she didn't do stupid dances on social media like Nikita does, and she busted her ass in the ring, and she said that for the people who aren't cheering her, screw you. She said that you people are the ones that look at Nikita's pictures online and dream of her at night. And I will say, you know, based on the comments that I see on social media, the thirst is real. She's not wrong about that. So, I mean, I thought the substance of the promo was fine. Her delivery was not great. I didn't think it was a great promo. But I think I'm also just kind of sick of the whole "you people" promo stuff, since I feel like we see it so many times. There was a contract signing with Booker T overseeing Wesley and Carmelo Hayes signing for their North American Championship match, which is coming up this week. Booker T was extra Booker T this week. He was, I don't know, he was all amped up. We had a last woman standing match for the NXT Women's Championship in the main event with Alba Fire challenging Mandy Rose. You know what my least favorite day of the week is? Monday. Monday is my least favorite. I love that accent. I don't say it to mock it. I love that accent. Every time she says it, every promo, because she's been feuding with Mandy now for like weeks and weeks and weeks. So every time she says her name, it goes, Mandy. Mandy, I'm going to take your championship, Mandy. And it looked like Alba had the match won. She was climbing a ladder outside the ring. She was getting ready for a swanton bomb or whatever it was she was going for. All of a sudden, we see Isla Dawn, former NXT UK star Isla Dawn, making her NXT debut. She shows up on the ladder. She spit, I guess, mist in Alba's face. That sent her falling backwards through the table. And she was unable to answer the count. And so Mandy is still the NXT Women's Champion. Yet another match where Mandy Rose is the beneficiary of some interference. She is the beneficiary of some assistance to retain her championship. This has been the story of her entire run. But that was how they closed out NXT this week. This week's Tales from the Territories focused on Portland Wrestling. More specifically, Don Owens Pacific Northwest Wrestling, which remains the longest running professional wrestling promotion ever in this country and second in the world only to CMLL in Mexico. So to give you some background not covered here in the episode, Portland Wrestling first debuted in 1954. They debuted on KPTV, which was Portland's very first TV station. And they stayed on the air for almost 40 years. I wonder if the viewers had to listen to the announcer every week talk about how they were the longest-running episodic television anywhere in the country. Probably not. Don Owen never paid for television, and he never signed a contract with the station to air the show, which is pretty amazing given that the show went on uninterrupted for, I think, 38 years. Don Owen was regarded as one of the few honorable promoters in a business that is just filled with con men and scumbags. After Owen passed away, Dory Funk Jr. told Slam Wrestling that Don Owen was the best payoff promoter in the business. He paid the boys what he said he would, right down to the penny. And he was just as nice of a guy. You know, if somebody got hurt on the job, you know, these days WWE pays for it, no questions asked. It's sort of expected, as they should. They have plenty of money to do so. In the territory days, those promoters were not making the kind of money that WWE and AEW are making today. And there was a story where Tim Flowers got his head busted open on the ring post one night and he needed $10,000 worth of plastic surgery. Don Owen paid the bill, no questions asked. So lots of big names got their start working in Portland, the biggest name being Rowdy Roddy Piper. But there were others, Buddy Rose, Dynamite Kid, Kurt Hennig, Adrian Adonis, Buzz Sawyer, Sergeant Slaughter, Jesse Ventura, Jimmy Snuka wrestled there, Andre the Giant worked in the territory, as did Ric Flair, a lot of people. For a territory that had a main roster that was relatively small, they did get a lot of big names to pass through. So for the round table, they had the Grappler, Len Denton, Princess Victoria, who did not work there more than a few weeks, Bushwhacker Luke, and Mike Masters, who I thought was the best of all the talking heads on this special. And I was very sad when at the very end of the episode, they flashed a message that he had passed away in August. He died from throat cancer. And he was 68 years old, didn't look it on this episode. He looked damn good for 68. So it sucks that he died before the episode aired. WWE fans would obviously know Luke and Butch as a kids act. They were basically a cartoon in the early 90s. They were working for Vince McMahon, but it's the run that they're most remembered for because Vince McMahon is the one who had national television. He had international television. So they went to Vince and they made their money, you know. But any footage of the Sheepherders from before their time in WWE shows a very different team than the one that, you know, I saw on television, for example, as a kid. They were violent. They were bloody. The polar opposite of the Bushwhackers. And Luke even said at the end of the episode, they went to WWE for one reason. The money. He said in the NWA, you were a wrestler. In WWE, you were a celebrity. The Sheepherders were scary dudes, but, you know, how can you fault the two of them for making more money for an easier job after years of working hardcore matches and scarring up their bodies? So Luke put over Don Owen for being ahead of the curve with how he made every show appear packed, even if it wasn't. The bleachers in the arena were on wheels, and so if they didn't sell enough tickets on a given night, they would just take that section out, they would roll the remaining sections together in such a way that made it look like it was packed. So even when they were not sold out, they were always sold out because that's how it looked on TV. I used to give Impact a lot of credit for that. When they finally went out on the road about 10 years ago, they got out of Florida and they took the show on the road, which didn't last very long. But they had a knack for making even the smallest crowds look much bigger on TV than they really were. And loud, too. But of course, no Territories episode would be complete without one disgusting story involving shitting, pissing, vomiting, or in this case, taking someone's cigar and sticking it up your asshole. That's what happened to Elton Owen. Elton Owen was the brother of Don Owen, who would be in charge at some of the spot shows that they did. So, you know, Don Owen was the promoter, and typically he was there. But when they would run these towns that were sort of on the outskirts, those were the spot shows, he would have his brother, you know, oversee things. He would let his brother be backstage and kind of oversee everything on a given night. Well, Luke said that Elton would be drunk every night. He was always smoking a cigar. And so he would leave the cigar to go up to his office, and Adrian Adonis would grab the cigar and would stick the non-lit end of it up his rear end. I mean, I would hope it was the they didn't actually say it, but I would hope it was the non-lit end. Otherwise, he would be in for a very painful surprise. But he would put the cigar back. And when Elton would come back, he would put the cigar right back in his mouth. And then he would wonder, why does it smell like someone took a shit in here? Before finally realizing the cigar was up somebody's ass, and now it is on his lips. So there was another story where Elton always carried a gun on him because the box office was all cash. And he didn't want to get caught one night with all that money on him and get robbed. The problem is he was a drunk. And so one night he got so drunk, he accidentally shot himself in the balls. I mean, right through the testicles. And the doctor thought maybe he tried to kill himself. And Elton explained to him, he goes, "Doc, if I wanted to off myself, I wouldn't have shot myself in the balls." I would concur. If that thought ever crossed my mind, and hopefully it never does, but if that thought ever crossed my mind, I could think of far less painful ways to go than shooting myself in the balls. So they talked about Playboy Buddy Rose, who is a very central figure in this territory. And as I go on here, it'll become very clear why. Even at the end of the territory, he became somebody who, without him, there's a lot of that Portland wrestling footage that would have been lost to time. But they talked about Buddy, and he was one of the territory's biggest heels. And growing up, watching WWF in the Northeast, I watched the Playboy Buddy Rose blowaway diet skit on WWE television. He was good for some comedy, but in Portland, he knew how to get heat. Like, I didn't look at him as anything serious in WWE. He was just a guy. He's a big guy, you know, who they made fun of him for being fat. They used him for comedy relief. And that's how I knew Buddy Rose when I was growing up as a wrestling fan. But the matches that he and Doug Summers had against Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty, those were classic back in the AWA. But that came years later. In Portland, it was the rivalry with Buddy Rose and Matt Bourne, who would go on to become Doink the Clown, the best Doink the Clown, evil Doink, Matt Bourne. Buddy started dating Matt's sister and married her in real life. Not long after this, there were rumors that Buddy was cheating on her with his longtime girlfriend, Tammy. This did not sit very well with Matt Bourne. So one night, Matt went to Buddy's house, he busted down the door, and he beat the shit out of him. And Buddy pressed charges, had him arrested. Bourne spent, I think, a couple of nights in jail. Even after he got out of jail, his first night back at the arena, he went right for Buddy. And the only reason he didn't kill him is because Matt's father, Tony, who was also a wrestler, Tony Bourne, he held him back. Mike Masters said that at first he wasn't sure if the wedding was a work or not, because he knew Buddy liked to get heat. So for all he knew, maybe the whole thing was just a put on. But one night when Buddy was in the car with him, they were driving home, and Buddy offered him $50 if Masters would drive home with him and would go into his house first, just to check and make sure that Matt Bourne wasn't there waiting for him. And Masters said that's when he knew the heat between them was very real. I mean, back in the territory days, a man parting with his money, he doesn't do that unless he is genuinely scared for his life. And he paid him. He paid him the $50, and Masters went and checked, and there was nobody there. Princess Victoria told the story of Buddy lobbying for her to take part in a battle royal with the men. With the idea that it would get him a ton of heat when he threw her out of the ring. And Buddy and another guy, I don't think they intended to hurt her, but basically the way they threw her out of the ring, they basically lawn darted this woman out of the ring and into a brick wall. And she slid down and she split her head open hard way. She's laying there in a puddle of blood. And she hasn't, what nobody knows is that she hasn't smartened up her family who was in the crowd that night. She hasn't smartened up her family yet to the wrestling business, that the whole thing is a work. So her brother, who maybe at the time is 17 years old, not very big, he tries to jump Buddy Rose. He tries to get in the ring and go after Buddy. And Buddy has at least 100 pounds on this guy. But, you know, he's going to defend his sister, not knowing that wrestling is a work. And she credited Buddy with making her as a babyface because of the heat that he got her on that night. It really, in her mind, did her career wonders. She ended up getting a run out of it working for WWE through Moolah, even though some of the boys, including Roddy Piper, warned her, do not work for Moolah. But she said it was a big opportunity for her, so she went. And they had great footage of Piper in this, too, and Luke talking about a cage match that he and Butch had against Piper and Rick Martel once. There was a road story about Piper being pulled over by the cops smoking weed, and then being taken to a judge's house at 2 o'clock in the morning. They had to pay a fine. After they left, they pissed all over the window outside the building because we can't have an episode without urination or defecation. I mean, you should know this by now. They talked about the downfall of the territory having to do with the commission getting involved with one of their new rules being no blood. And if somebody did bleed, the match would have to be immediately stopped. Now, this is a promotion. You got to remember, like a lot of the territories that use blood all the time, AEW would have been a perfect territory back in the day. The mentality was red equals green. This is where the infamous Breakfast Club angle came from, which they covered here with John Nord, who would go on to become the Berserker. He was tagging with the Grappler against the young Brian Adams, who would go on to become Crush. They couldn't use blood, but Nord had a way around that. He bought up like 10 gallons of milk and boxes of cereal from the supermarket, and they used that instead. And the Grappler thought he was nuts, but they got all of this stuff and in the ring that night. I mean, they're hammering, you know, Adams with the gallon jugs, and the milk is splattering all over the people in the front row and splattering all over the mat. Don Owen chewed them out after, because now he's going to have to go clean the mat. So they were dubbed the Breakfast Club after that. Matt Bourne, he bled in a match on TV. He tried to pass it off his hard way. Nobody believed him. And they got shut down for a week. And with the commission, you know, breathing down their necks and watching their every move, and you have Vince McMahon expanding across the country, now he's expanding out west, the Grappler says that he knew the writing was on the wall for the company. Vince McMahon wanted the television in Portland. He was paying the station $3,500 a week when Don Owen wasn't paying them a dime. So it was an easy decision for the station manager to make. Who are you going to go with? These guys are willing to pay us $3,500 a week, and they have the biggest, most nationally recognized wrestling product right now in the country. Or we can just keep going with Portland, with Don Owen, who isn't paying us a cent. It's a pretty easy decision to make. But the reality is that by the early 90s, when Portland finally went down, there were very few territories left. Don Owen, Jerry Jarrett, they were two of the only ones left standing. The pressure from Vince McMahon did not help, but there were other issues which, you know, they didn't even get into. Namely, the TV station moving them to a different time slot after midnight so that they can make room for paid programming in their old time slot. And then it wasn't long after that the numbers started to dwindle. And that, coupled with how many hours of wrestling there was on basic cable every week, because there were more options than ever before, Portland wasn't the only thing people could watch now. And some of those names that got big in Portland were now even bigger stars working either in WWE or WCW. Those things really just kind of conspired together to lead to the downfall of the promotion. You know, the television show was their best advertisement for selling tickets to live shows. Very much the way that Memphis worked. It was every Monday at the Mid-South Coliseum. There was a big show. Jerry Lawler against this guy, Jerry Lawler against that guy. So they had Memphis TV, but the TV was there to promote the show on Monday and the live events to sell tickets, because that was the lifeblood of the business. Wrestling now is very different. It's less so about selling tickets. And, you know, if you can get that guaranteed TV money, like WWE has a guaranteed $50 million for every Saudi Arabia show. You know, selling tickets is still important, but it's not nearly as important as it was 30 years ago. But back then, that was the lifeblood of every company. You don't sell tickets, you don't make money. It's very simple. You know, and if fewer people are watching the TV show, that means that fewer people are buying tickets. And if fewer people are buying tickets, you're going to have a dead territory. Now, one last thing they mentioned, and this is the part that I found really interesting. You often hear about a lot of territories in the 70s and even in the 80s using the same master tapes over and over again to save on money. So a lot of their old shows were taped over because they just kept using the same tapes. And all that footage is gone. It's lost forever. It was the same with Portland. But Buddy Rose taped every single show from his time in Portland so that he could watch his matches back and critique them. So I did a little digging. Buddy was friends with a man named Rich Patterson. Rich Patterson was a Portland wrestling fan from the time that he was a kid. And he is a Portland wrestling historian today. In 1996... Buddy told him that he had all these tapes in his garage that he couldn't play anymore because he didn't have a machine. And they're taking up too much space, so I'm just going to throw them away unless you want them. So Patterson took the tapes. And a lot of them were unmarked, so he wasn't even sure what was on them. But they were in a format that predated Beta and VHS called the Quasar Great Time Machine. I never even knew this, and I started reading up on this the other day. It's this format called the Quasar Great Time Machine. It came out right before Betamax. They stopped making the machines after 1978. It took them 2 years to even find a machine and then get it fixed. There were about 40 of those tapes in his collection. They had collected dust and molds. So he had to clean that out. In those tapes, he found the only known Portland footage of Jimmy Snuka and Jesse Ventura. But he was able to restore the footage of the Roddy Piper-Buddy Rose feud. In all, he got 26 hours of Portland footage from 1977 to 1979 out of those tapes. The 900 or so VHS tapes that he got from Buddy's widow after he passed away, she was going to junk them. She said, I'm either going to throw them away or I'm going to donate them to Goodwill. And so, of course, Patterson said, I'll take them. And that had about 275 hours of Portland footage from 1980 all the way through 1991. So, all told, he has over 300 hours of Portland TV, and you can find those episodes on YouTube right now. All thanks to Buddy Rose. Were it not for him wanting to critique his own matches, they would have been lost forever. So, I really liked this episode. I liked it a lot more than I did the Stampede one from a couple of weeks ago. This Tuesday, it is World Class out of Dallas. That's the Von Erichs. And we still have Jim Crockett Promotions and Mid-South to round out the season. I thought there was only one episode left. I thought World Class was the last one for some reason. Meanwhile, I forgot the two biggest episodes, probably the two of the biggest territories. So we actually have three episodes left. All right, let's tackle some of your mailbag questions here. We got a bunch of them, so let's barrel through these before I pass out. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Jacob from Reno, Nevada. You've mentioned that the match for the Raw Women's Championship at WrestleMania should be Bianca Belair against Rhea Ripley, and I could not agree more. But that leaves Charlotte out of the picture. Now, while I do like Charlotte, I hate when she's inserted into a match to make it a triple threat, so I pose this scenario for you that gives us three marquee matches for the women. You have Bianca and Rhea for the Raw title, the Four Horsewomen in a four-way, and for the SmackDown Women's Championship, you'd have Ronda Rousey against Shayna Baszler. You can even split the Fatal 4-Way and have Becky against Bayley and Charlotte against Sasha. What do you think? If they are ever going to do Ronda Rousey against Becky Lynch, one-on-one, LA next year is it. And that is a much bigger match than Ronda Rousey against Shayna Baszler. You know, they could do Ronda against Shayna, but not a WrestleMania. And I would not be so quick to break up Ronda and Shayna. The timing, I mean, again, what's the rush, right? They just put them together on TV. So, yeah, keep it going for a while. So, you do Becky against Ronda, the timing will never be better. Ronda's a heel now. Becky's going to come back as a babyface. A four-way with the horsewomen would be a nice attraction, but it should be Becky against Ronda. You take Becky out, you don't have your four horsewomen. You're also, by the way, assuming that Sasha Banks is going to be back by then. We don't know that. We still don't know what is going on with Sasha Banks. And then you do Bianca against Rhea for the Raw Women's title. I'm starting to think that what they may do is hold off on Edge and Beth Phoenix coming back until around Royal Rumble time and then set up for a big singles match at WrestleMania with Rhea Ripley and Beth Phoenix. Which, if they do that, that would open up Charlotte Flair to come in and challenge Bianca for the Raw Women's Championship. Sufi from Malaysia. With the NWA World Heavyweight Championship having been devalued again, it makes me think, why didn't Vince McMahon think to buy the NWA during the 90s? Considering that the NWA was a big wrestling organization, why wasn't Vince interested? Is it because the NWA had no value around that time? And is there still any value today if Triple H were to be interested? Well, Vince McMahon was not going to be buying anything in the early 90s because he wouldn't have, you know, the NWA was still somewhat strong at that point, not really. Vince McMahon did not have the kind of money back in the early and mid 90s that he had much later on. But you got to remember, the NWA was not a promotion. It was a body. It was an alliance of different member organizations. There's an intellectual property there that you can buy in terms of the logo and things of that nature, but that's really what it was. It wasn't a promotion in the traditional sense. As the 90s wore on, the NWA meant less and less. Shane Douglas threw down the NWA title and ECW went extreme. WCW no longer had any NWA affiliation, and they got hot with the NWO angle, and WWE took off with the Austin and McMahon feud, The Rock, DX. Wrestling was hot, and the NWA was old hat. It was a relic. You know, they did a little angle in 98 in WWE. Jim Cornette, right? The whole, they brought the NWA in. Jeff Jarrett came back as, like, the NWA North American champion. It was very short-lived because it just wasn't going to work. It didn't fit. In the Attitude Era, it didn't fit. TNA had the NWA affiliation when it first started. And within a few years, they split away because they weren't willing to pay the fees that were associated with being part of the NWA. They didn't need them. Now that they were established, you know, why are we going to pay these guys? For the three initials, we don't need them. Even today, Billy Corgan is a wrestling fan. He was nostalgic for the old days. He wanted to try to make the NWA mean something again. Not unlike what Tony Khan has done with Ring of Honor. He saw Ring of Honor going down the tubes. Maybe Vince would have swooped in and picked the bones. He didn't want that to happen. He grew up, he was a big fan of Ring of Honor, so he bought it. And now he's trying to figure out a way to breathe life into it and make it meaningful again. But the NWA is never going to mean what it used to mean. You know, for a while, I thought Corgan did a good job of recapturing that old school studio wrestling feel. But the product just doesn't have the charm that it used to. But Vince McMahon never bought the NWA because he didn't need it. What would he have done with it? Is there a tape library? Do the trademarks have any real value for him? It probably wasn't even worth it. If it was, he would have had it because he could spend more than anybody else could. Right? He could have spent more, like early 2000s or whatever. He had more money than anybody else at that time. So at that point, if he wanted it, I'm sure he could have had it. Liam from Saskatchewan. In a recent interview with Chris Van Vliet, Billy Corgan said that he can see a wrestling landscape in 10 years with WWE, AEW, Impact, AAA, New Japan, and the NWA all being important in the American market. Well, I mean, of course he would say that. Say that by some miracle this actually were to happen, how do you think the wrestling world would look with six important wrestling companies in the U.S., and do you think there is enough popular talent that this many major companies could be sustainable? I don't. Actually, I mean, that's a lot. I mean, you're talking about all six thriving and being big in this country. I don't think the talent pool, frankly, is big enough to sustain six of them. Maybe half that. But I don't see AAA taking off in the States. I know they're trying right now. They're trying to break into the American market more. I don't see AAA or New Japan, to be perfectly honest with you, taking off in any kind of major or meaningful way. The NWA sure as shit ain't going to take off in that way. It's a place where people can find work and can ply their craft and then move up to an AEW or move up to a WWE. NWA, I mean, it's nice to have goals, but no, I don't see the NWA taking off in the way that Billy Corgan says. It's just not realistic. I don't see it happening. Chase from Middleton, Wisconsin. Buy, sell, or rent on who you would rather see John Cena face at WrestleMania. Logan Paul, Austin Theory, or Stone Cold Steve Austin. The fan in me wants to see Cena against Austin just for the... Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of the appeal of taking two big names and putting them in the ring together. I think it would do wonders for Theory to get the match. I would buy on Cena. I'm sorry, Austin. I would buy on Austin. I would rent on Theory. I would sell on Logan Paul. If they can get Randy Orton back in time, if they can get Seth Rollins, you know, in a position to maybe have a program with him, imagine a Seth Rollins-Logan Paul match, right? I think that would be tremendous. Michael from Delaware, Ohio. With the recent 25th anniversary of the Montreal Screwjob, plus Bret Hart saying that he wished he had stayed in WWE, how would the company have looked if Bret did not jump to WCW and the Screwjob never happened? Obviously, things like DX and the rise of Stone Cold were already brewing, but what about the Mr. McMahon character? Or how would this affect the rise of main eventers like The Rock and Mankind? I think The Rock and Mankind would have been just fine. Bret Hart loved The Rock. And Foley was very good friends with Bret. I don't think Bret's presence would have done any damage to them getting over in the way that they did. It would have been another big name at the top of the card that you kind of have to fight through. But I think The Rock would have been just fine. I think Mankind would have been fine. I think eventually we would have gotten the Mr. McMahon character. I just feel like we got a taste of it in Memphis in 93. And he just looked like he was having fun doing the heel character. And with Bischoff being a heel character on TV, I just figured it was only a matter of time before Vince got in on the game too. Regardless of what happened in Montreal. Maybe it wouldn't have happened as quickly. But I still feel like we would have ended up with that Mr. McMahon character at some point. He always wanted to be a wrestler. He's talked about this. His father didn't want him to be. He said, no, you're going to be an announcer. So at some point, I'm sure he would have gotten the itch and he would have gotten in the ring and he would have been a character on TV. And I'm glad he did. Because as an on-air character back when he was in his prime, I mean, not today, but like back then, he was tremendous. He was better than anybody I had ever seen in that role. I mean, he was tremendous. Andrew from Rochester, Minnesota. Do you think airing 205 Live after NXT, once the Cruiserweight title became an NXT title, would have lengthened the life of the brand? They could have used NXT to promote the show, and I believe the NXT audience, both in person and those watching, would have been more likely to stick around and watch than those watching or attending SmackDown. No, I don't think it would have made a difference. I think it was a dead brand no matter what. I don't think it would have made a lick of difference, to be perfectly honest with you. Mike in Lakeland, Florida, after listening to your comments in Sound Off 782, and with no personal bias, buy or sell on the stronger all-women's pay-per-view, WWE Evolution or NWA Empower? Evolution, was that 2018? Evolution was one of the better WWE shows that entire year, with the best of all the matches that Charlotte Flair and Becky Lynch ever had. Remember, Shayna Baszler had a really good match on that show, I think, with Kairi Sane for the NXT Women's Championship. Empower also had some really good matches. They had Camille against Layla Hirsch, Deonna Purrazzo against Melina. They had a nice retirement segment where Awesome Kong announced her retirement. Gail Kim had no idea that she was going to do that. It was a cool moment between the two of them. Evolution gets my vote because the what I remember about the Empower show, as much as I thought it was a good show, what I remember is the commentary for the NWA show was abysmal. Velvet Sky was just absolutely insufferable on that show. Plus, I think her mic volume was up too high. It was clipping. Like, it was awful. Evolution was the stronger show overall. So they were both very good, but Evolution would get my vote. Evan from Las Vegas. Everyone can agree, well, aside from Ric Flair, that he should have remained retired after WrestleMania 24. What about Hulk Hogan? What was the ideal retirement match for Hulk Hogan? Personally, I think the WrestleMania 19 match with Vince McMahon would have been a fitting end had he stopped there. There was a plan to do Hulk Hogan against John Cena at WrestleMania 25, but Hogan had back surgery a couple of months before. He wasn't able to do the match. That would have been the best send-off that he could have gotten. You do the job to the flag bearer for that current era, and not unlike, you know, the match that he had with The Rock in Toronto at WrestleMania 8. I have to specify because they had two matches in Canada. But the WrestleMania match, very similar, where you have Cena and Hogan, right? This battle of the generations, and it's at WrestleMania and the silver anniversary of WrestleMania, no less, on the show that Hogan helped create. And then he poses to Real American to close out the night. That would have been perfect. That would have been the perfect send-off for Hogan. Chris from New Jersey, I was wondering if WCW's pay-per-views and Nitros were actual sellouts. I feel like everyone that I watched has a massive amount of people at them, but they are giving little to no reaction to what is going on, or they're just holding up four fingers for the Four Horsemen. Were these fans paid plants, or were they legit? Also, did you ever notice the lack of reaction to WCW's actual in-ring product, aside from the biggest moments like Hogan turning and Goldberg winning the title? One more question. How come WCW never had any memorable themes, and the audio for the theme songs was always super low? Let me take this in order here. Like any promotion, there were times, I'm sure, where they said they were sold out and they really weren't. They were close to sold out, or they made it look sold out. And then there were other times where when WCW was hot, they had a lot of legitimate sellouts. No, they were not paid plants. It's not like half the crowd was paid to be there. They were legitimate people. You know, if there were shows where they weren't reacting, it's because they had nothing to react to. I remember them reacting to the Cruiserweights on Nitro when they were in the ring. They reacted to the big stars when they were out there. Sting, Hogan, Goldberg, DDP, right? The People's Champ. So I'm not sure what shows you're referring to, but no, they were not planted fans. And, you know, as far as saying that how come WCW never had any memorable themes, I mean, my God, I can rattle off a whole bunch off the top of my head. Ravishing Rick Rude. Talk about a catchy theme song. You had Ravishing Rick Rude, Diamond Dallas Page with the Nirvana knockoff, A Man Called Sting, He Does This, He Does That. Goldberg had pretty badass music, The Wolfpack, The Four Horsemen, any of their themes. There was one theme in particular, though. It sounded like a porn theme, but that's my favorite version of the Horsemen music. So, I mean, WCW had plenty of banger theme songs. I have no idea what you're talking about. EJ from Illinois. The most disgusting promotional tactic is my favorite award from the Observer every single year because it calls out the bullshit that we have seen companies do. I was looking at the early winners, and I have no idea about some of them or why they were disgusting. I was wondering what you knew about each of the following. So he lists them here. 1981, Tony Hernandez's monster character from LaBelle Promotions. So I looked this up. I wanted to see what the hell this was about. There was nothing disgusting about it. It was just a silly gimmick where Tony Hernandez came out dressed like Frankenstein, literally with a mask and everything. He came out dressed like Frankenstein doing a gimmick where he was a real life monster who was made in a laboratory. This promotion was on its last legs. I can't imagine why with ideas like that. But this was the promoter's last ditch effort to try to keep business going, and spoiler, it didn't work. 1982, Bob Backlund winning the WWF Championship. Yeah, the Backlund one, I knew you were going to mention that one. The Backlund one has always been puzzling to me too. From what I can piece together, Meltzer and the readers of the newsletter at the time were, and Meltzer in particular, was completely sick of Bob Backlund as the champion. This was 82. Backlund had been the champion since 79? 78 or 79? I forgot now. Maybe 79. But he had been the champion for a number of years by that point. Like, as sick as some people say they are now of Roman Reigns as champion, add a couple of years onto that. So I think that's really all it boiled down to. You know, he was kind of just the classic, you know, baby face, and people were just sick of it. They were sick of him being on top. There was nothing disgusting about it. I guess 82 was a quiet year otherwise when it came to disgusting promotional tactics. So they just gave it to Backlund for being shoved down people's throats. Imagine how many of these awards John Cena or Roman Reigns would have won if that was the criteria. 1984, rather. He says, Blackjack Mulligan's fake heart attack in championship wrestling from Florida. I mean, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. 1992, WCW pushing Eric Watts. Well, I mean, Eric Watts just wasn't very good. It was just a nepotism thing, which has always been a thing in pro wrestling and always will be. 1994, Ric Flair's retirement angle. You know, again, nothing disgusting about that, but it was pretty stupid. And then 1995, he says Gene Okerlund's 900 hotline ads. Yeah, so that I understand. So WCW was very successful with the hotline. I don't know how much of a piece of that Okerlund got. I think Okerlund got a large piece of it because it was basically his. That was the whole 1-900-909-9900. I still, after all these years, that's how effective it was. That number is still burned in my brain. He would go on TV and he would promote these updates on the WCW hotline that were total bullshit. Like, if there were rumors about a WWF guy that might be coming to WCW, you know, he would tease it and make you think that, you know, there was some big news he was going to break on the hotline. And then it was him basically talking about rumors that had been going around. It was that sort of thing. It was very scummy. So that's really what he was referring to. That's why when they did the billionaire Ted skits in WWE, they had him as a character. They called him Scheme Gene. And they made fun of his hotline updates. So that's all that was. So anyway, some good questions this week. We'll cut it off there. Keep emailing me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. I am getting ready. I mean, it's so late now. It's almost dinner time. Jesus. So tonight is the series finale of The Walking Dead. And I feel like I'm one of the few left. I remember when this show was pulling in like 20 million an episode at its peak. I think it gets maybe like a million now, but I stuck with it. And there have been some great seasons and there have been some bad seasons of The Walking Dead. They've also had different showrunners. I know a lot of people gave up on the show, season 4, 5, 6. But I will say that this season now, yeah, they're up to, they're 11 seasons in. And I think Angela Kang is the name of the showrunner. The show has definitely improved. Like, this has been one of the better seasons, probably since the ones that I mentioned. So the show has rebounded nice, which is good. You want the show to end at least on somewhat of a high note. But I've been through all the highs and lows. I remember how monumental this show was when it first debuted on AMC. And, you know, this the stuff early with Shane, who I still can't believe they killed off Shane as quickly as they did. And this is coming from somebody, I never read the comics. So I went into the TV show fresh. I didn't want to know what the because in some cases they deviated from the comics. In others, it was just like they ripped it right from the comics. And I'm just like, I don't want to know. I don't want to read any of that. I just want to go into it fresh. Maybe one day I'll go back and read the comics, but that was never my thing. So I never knew what was coming next and the different characters and then, you know, the Whisperers and all the different story. We had the Governor and we had Negan and but there have been some great characters on this show. The Governor is still, honestly, the Governor might still be my favorite character. I think that was season 3, or maybe 4. And then Negan came a little bit later on, and he's great. You know, Jeffrey Dean Morgan is great in the role, but there's been so many great characters over the years, and they've killed off so many characters. I look back on this run, and I said this on Twitter earlier. There was an episode from season 4, The Grove, which has the scene with Carol, you know, telling the kid, look at the flowers. To me, that is still the most gut-wrenching hour of television that I have ever seen. And one of the best episodes in the entire series. So there are certain episodes like that that stand out to me. The episode that I think opened up the 6th or 7th season, I forget which, it might have been season 7. I'm trying to avoid like outright spoilers here, but if you've seen the show or maybe it was in the comics, you know what I'm talking about. The Negan scene where everybody from the group is down on their knees and we all know what happened next. I mean, that to me, it's rare that I watch a TV show and I could feel my heart about to pound out of my chest. I had so much fun actually going on YouTube after the fact and looking up reaction videos to that episode and seeing people's reactions to what happened. Like, there have been some genuinely shocking moments on this show over the years. So I'm going to miss it. I may be one of the few still hanging in there at the end, but I'm going to miss the show. I know there's going to be a spinoff. There was going to be a spinoff with Daryl and Carol, and I think Carol now is no longer part of it because she didn't want to move to where they were filming. I'll probably follow those as well. Yeah, I'm a sucker for The Walking Dead. What can I say? So anyway, if you are going to watch the show, do enjoy. I don't know that I'm going to do a recap or anything like that. I just want to watch it, enjoy it. Hopefully they give it a proper ending. And that is how I will spend my night until I pass out. Because I am running on fumes. It has been a very long week. I've been streaming almost every single day. I hope you guys appreciate it, enjoyed it. I hope it was worth it. Put a lot of work and time into everything, and it'll be more of the same this week. We have Thanksgiving coming up. I hope everybody celebrating has a very happy Thanksgiving. You get to spend it with somebody that you like or you love. I am thankful for all of your support, not just 1 week out of the year, but all 52 weeks a year. And I'll be back with you next Sunday, as always, for episode 784 of this longest-running episodic wrestling podcast. Or maybe it's not the longest, but it's one of the longest. 15 years. It's a long time. Be well. Stay safe. Happy Turkey Day. And I will see you guys back here for episode 784 next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonsters sounds off.
Punk brought his dog to the show because they were in Chicago, and so for whatever reason, he decided that it would be a great idea to bring his dog to the show. Anybody who has a pet, a dog, a cat, a gerbil, a hamster, a tiger, a bear, a lion, a zebra, a horse, a mosquito, whatever it might be, right? It's your pet. You would do anything for your pet. So we don't know if Punk reacted the way he did because Larry had the door kicked in his face, if in fact that's what happened. I would also say that maybe people ought to stop bringing their fucking pets to these AEW shows because it doesn't seem to go very well. Maybe, just maybe, leave the fucking dogs at home.
The Solomonster sounds off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster sounds off.